You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear interviews with two writers, Angela Palm and Melissa Garlieb. The first interview is with Angela Palm, local writer and editor of the recent Vermont anthology, Please Do Not Remove. Raised in the rural Midwest, Angela Palm earned a BA in English Literature and a BS in Criminal Justice at St. Joseph's College. She owns Ink and Lead Literary Services. Her second book, an essay collection titled Riverine, is forthcoming from Grey Wolf Press in spring 2016. Angela is the editor of Please Do Not Remove, a book featuring work by Vermont writers, part celebration of vintage library ephemera and part literary eclecticism. Each piece in the anthology is inspired by used library checkout cards. Angela is a contributor at Book Trib, a literary lifestyle magazine. Angela Palm's writing has appeared in, or is forthcoming from, Paper Darts, Apt, Hippocampus Magazine, Midwestern Gothic, Ardor Literary Magazine, Little Fiction, Sundog Lit, Prick of the Spindle, Tampa Review Online, Burlington Free Press, and elsewhere. She was a nonfiction editor at The Fiddleback, a literary journal. Her essay, The Devolution of Cake, published in Big Truths, was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. She attended the Breadloaf Writers Conference in 2013. Angela Palm lives in Burlington, Vermont, where she is working on her third book. When I spoke to her, we discussed Please Do Not Remove, published by Windridge Books of Vermont. The collection includes 20 works of prose and poetry by writers who represent Vermont's rich literary tradition. Each piece in the book is inspired by an old library card, checkout card, and incorporates libraries in some way. Corresponding color photographs of the cards, taken by Nick Adams, are printed alongside each work. 10% of the book's net proceeds go to the Vermont Library Association. I should say, just full disclosure, that I do have a story in the collection, and I've been honored to be a part of it. So when I spoke with Angie Palm about Please Do Not Remove, I began by asking her if she has any early memories of a local library or a special librarian.
I have early fond memories of first the library in the elementary school that I went to, where I would go because I was one of the few kids that could already read in kindergarten, and they would send us to the library instead of participating in the learning to read portion of the class. So I would just explore everything. I would get, they had, you know, one of those really big, like 8-inch thick dictionaries that was on a special pedestal, and I would spend time just reading the dictionary and really nerding out in the library. So yes, I have a lot of good library memories.
Isn't that so great, those memories of just like, it felt like such a safe, cozy place.
They really did. It was a safe sort of home for me, and I think that's really where my love of reading started, and you know, like so many writers and readers, for sure.
So I wonder if you can describe Please Do Not Remove and also talk a little bit about how it began for you.
Sure. Please Do Not Remove is a collection of writing by Vermont authors that includes poetry, prose, both fiction and nonfiction, and color photographs that are taken by a Vermont artist as well. And each of the photographs are of old library cards themselves, nice color photographs. And then the stories and poems are inspired by those individual cards. So it's a compilation of those. And it really started when I came across a bundle of these cards on Etsy. I was looking for a gift for a friend, and I thought, oh, I hadn't seen those for so long, and remembered how, you know, just in a nostalgic way, how kind of cool they were and a part of the library process. So I bought them because they were like $5. And then I realized that it was really hard to find them anywhere because pretty much most of the libraries in the U.S. have switched over to digital or electronic checkout, and there are also some new privacy laws that are part of that. And so I kept ordering them because I realized how they were kind of becoming extinct, so that was sort of interesting. And I really started looking at them and looking at the different people and the different types of handwriting of the people who had checked them out, and just finding myself get really curious about who those people were and like why they had, you know, checked out a certain book or what their connection was to it or how they'd been affected by it. especially when you see like really, really random titles, like what was somebody doing checking out the New Hampshire Civil Record book? You know,
yeah.
I'm just curious. So that's kind of how it started.
Okay. So how did you get out the word when you were requesting submissions for the book?
I turned to my writing group first, and they wrote some wonderful pieces that just showed me that it was a fun project, and I was so excited about it that I got in contact with the folks at the New England Review, and they helped spread the word about submissions. And I also posted it on my website and, you know, used Twitter and social media to spread the word, and got a lot of interest from writers all over the place who I'd never met or heard of, and some really accomplished writers too, and some people who were just inspired to write something for the first time, which was really cool too. And even some librarians who were not necessarily writers but were excited about the project and wanted to give it a try too. So that was really fun.
Yeah. You didn't have a publisher when you began the project.
Right.
So I wanted to just talk about how you went about finding one and how you would have proceeded if you hadn't found one, which you did. But
I did apply for a grant initially to try to publish the book myself, and I did not get the grant. And I had really thought of it as such a pet project at the time that I hadn't really thought about how I would find a publisher if I wasn't going to publish it myself. But then once I started getting really good submissions and you know, saw the beautiful photographs, I thought that it really would make a nice book, and I think someone would be interested in publishing it. So I queried 4 or 5 publishers in Vermont and heard back from a couple of them, and that's how I got connected with Windridge.
Mm-hmm. What was your favorite part of putting the collection together as its editor?
Oh, that's a great question. I guess I would say looking at the diversity of ideas and really seeing how those were so different, how everybody was so differently affected by the cards that they chose. There was a moment where one of the writers pulled me aside, and this is before the book came out, it was Mary Jane Dickerson, and she told me that when she received her card because she wanted to participate in writing something for the book, that she experienced this memory of her mother just by looking at that card that she hadn't remembered, like that she hadn't thought of since she was 6 years old or something. And it was this really touching, beautiful moment, and it was a beautiful story, and I think she had lost her mother, so it was just this really unique experience that happened, and that really made it kind of hit home for me, like how people really do have these connections to artifact in this way that can be a conduit for memories and,
right,
you know, feelings and different experiences. That was probably one of the highlights for me.
Oh, that's great.
Which isn't an editing thing, but that's sort of why you love stories and why you love editing is that
too,
human connection.
Yeah, you're the person who would hear that story.
Right.
Her. Yeah. How many submissions did you get, and how many submissions did you take?
I received about 65 submissions. So not a ton, but a good number, and I accepted 20 pieces of those.
All right. So is that hard?
It was very hard, especially because some of the writers I knew personally, so that was very difficult, and, you know, it's just a challenging thing to do. But I think that a lot of the, you know, some of the stories that didn't get in or the poems that didn't get in were still good poems, and I tried to encourage people to continue working on those and submitting them elsewhere because they did have some really, really great value as standalone pieces.
Yeah. So I know that the Vermont Department of Libraries was involved a little bit with this project. So what was their role?
So actually it was the Vermont Library Association, which are two different entities.
Oh.
I didn't realize at the time. So one is the state agency, and then one is the association that represents the librarians themselves and the libraries themselves.
Okay.
So I don't think it's administered by the state, per se, but that's who I've been in touch with. And Tony Josie, who's the president of the Vermont Library Association, has been really wonderful and has been very excited about the project. And she has been helping connect me with libraries, and I'm going to be reading at their annual meeting in May, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
And I think initially we were going to partner maybe with the State Department of Libraries, and then that didn't end up happening, although we did talk about the project.
Okay. When you sent out library cards for people to use as their writing prompts, did you try to match them up with people in any way?
I did do a little bit of matchmaking. Some of the writers I had known kind of what they write and where they fall on the wide spectrum of things to write about and, and form and things like that. And I did try to play a little bit to what I thought would intrigue them or spark their interest. And I also sent people a couple options, you know, like something that was really probably in left field for them, and then something that might be a little bit more in line with things they write about, like if it was a historical book or if it was, you know, something of that nature, or if it was a poet, sending a poet another poet's name. I know it was sort of a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
But it was also fun to challenge people a little bit too, and have them receive something that they just would have no contact with in any way. So that was fun.
Now, did you have any requirements about how closely they stuck to the card as a inspiration?
Initially, no. It was really kind of open season for any way that you were affected by the card or any sort of element that you pulled from it, whether that was an absence of people checking out the book interpreted as silence. And one person did take it in that direction, Jericho Parms, her piece on borrowing. She had received a Wordsworth or Longfellow? I think it was a Longfellow card, and nobody had checked it out, and she wrote this really beautiful essay on absence. It's a very, very cool piece.
Yeah.
So, and then others were much more direct, where they used names, they used dates, they used time frames, they used subject matter, or even the title of the book pretty directly. So there's a good range. But I'm kind of glad that it came out that way. The only thing that we changed later, and this was something that I sort of agreed upon with the publisher, was that we would try to link them a little bit further in some way, so that you'll notice if you read through the pieces that they all touch on libraries, or not necessarily take place in a library, but libraries as an entity pop up in every piece, which I do think it's a really nice
trend. So you had to go back to some writers and say...
Well, so many did that already.
Oh, that's interesting.
And at first I was discouraging that because I didn't want it to be like, oh, this is just a book about libraries, you know, and have it have this secondary theme or something. But as it turned out, about 75% of the submissions did do that. Mm-hmm. And we sort of decided to see that as a positive thing and to make it work for the whole book.
Okay. So, all right. Great. Would you do another anthology either as a follow-on to this one or another one?
I would, and we've talked about doing them in other states or regions of the country, which I think would be really, really exciting, and I would love to get the American Library Association involved in that. I think it could be a great way to raise awareness for libraries.
Yeah.
So I am looking into that. Although, I just came across this book that's being published by Grey Wolf, and it's, I forget who the author is, I'll have to go back and look, but it's coming out in 2015, and it's a collection of work inspired by library cards, but it's all written by the same author.
Oh.
Which is also a great way to take it.
Yeah,
so, I don't know, the market might be getting a little saturated. It's definitely something I want to pursue, looking into with other writers in other states who could help get it off the ground. I think it helps to have a couple of solid writers in your pocket who could, you know, help get other people excited about submitting to an anthology like that. So we will be looking into that for 2015.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So you have a story in Please Do Not Remove called Mrs. Greenwood's Jelly.
Yes.
Can you talk about your own library card and where you took it to write your story?
Absolutely. So Mrs. Greenwood's Jelly began, it really began this whole book. I'd received a library card that had been checked out twice in the 1930s. And the book itself wasn't all that interesting. It was a bibliography. Like, it didn't contain any actual literature, just a bibliography of literature, which I'd never seen as a book. And I thought that was sort of interesting and different, so I learned something there. And one of the people who had checked that book out was Mrs. Greenwood, who had written her name Mrs. Greenwood, no first name, and I was intrigued by that, given that it was the 1930s and that it's so different from how I would ever write my name to you know, something like checking a library book out or anything that you would put your name to. I wouldn't call myself Mrs. Palm. So I started thinking about her in that time period and who she might have been, and found myself getting pretty curious about what the sort of traditional roles of women looked like then and how they were shifting. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I learned was that birth control had become legal for the first time in the U.S. And I Don't know how I fell down that rabbit hole exactly. It had something to do with internet searches, and there I was, and then I found myself reading these old ads from an art and beauty magazine, which was a real magazine, and they were for birth control and different books about learning about the female body, and I thought, well, that was clearly something Mrs. Greenwood would have done, so I wrote a story around that.
Okay. Okay. Great. Now, you already mentioned that your library card checkout date, one of the dates is 1939, and the story has this feel of an earlier time. I don't think you ever name the date within your story, but, you know, the products and the vocabulary, the expressions, you talk about a percolator, a sweeper, steel wool, which are all things that still exist, but they felt very old-timey to me reading the story, right? So I just wondered the extent to which you did research of the times and how much is just your sense of how things were then.
A little bit of it was my sense of how things were, and I tried not to make it overly cliche and feel like it was just sort of what I happen to remember I know about that time period. But I did do research as far as what items in the home would have actually been there, what they would have been referred to as, like the percolator, the sweeper. And I did a little bit of research on dialogue, too, and what common phrasing was for the time period. And I researched cars and street names and all sorts of little details.
Now, I'm curious, do you go to the library to do research, or do you do your research from home on the internet?
I do both.
You do?
I would say 75% at home and 25% out in the world or in the library.
Okay. That's good to know that you still go to
the library. I do. They're great places.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you, and you touched on this already a little bit, but Mrs. Greenwood, your main character, how did you relate to her as you wrote about her? Did you feel her as a peer, or did you feel her more as like a very distant woman from your experience, more like your grandmother's generation?
I felt that she would have been someone maybe like my grandmother, but that also that we shared some common ideas about traditional families that are challenged from time to time. So I did share that sort of struggle with her about how to be traditional, but also being true to who you really think you are and what that balance might look like, and being part of a shifting modernism, I guess I would say. Like, I think that's an ongoing thing. Like, there are ongoing shifts in how people exist in marriages. So I think that's always been happening, and it was happening in the 30s, and I felt like she could be my aunt or my grandmother or something like that, that I could relate to in that way.
One thing that I thought you did really well was you talk about her husband sitting at the kitchen table in the morning. I'm making this up. I think that's what it was. And he's talking about the banking and the economy, and she makes this kind of aside about how, you know, he would assume that she even understood these things. And it was really well done because, of course, today we're all, you know, feminists or at least modern-minded enough to think that we want to be understood, or that we want to be expected to understand about these things.
Right.
But the way you wrote about it was like, it was really clear, like, women weren't even expecting themselves to understand these things back then.
That's true. And I don't think that was probably true of all women, but I wanted it to be true for her and be true to her experience, which is that she was a farm girl, you know, and that just wasn't her background. And also, it wasn't the societal expectation that she would be aware of those things. But at the same time, she wanted other sort of feminist ideas.
Right.
So I sort of thought there was something in that tension that I liked.
Yeah. Let's go back to the collection a little bit. One of the things you had to do was decide about accepting poetry. And you're not, to my knowledge, a poet,
correct?
Are you?
No,
right?
I am not.
So how was that? Was that hard? Like, did you feel like it was really clear which poems were standing out above the rest?
Some of them were hands down amazing poems. And for me, that's what the best poetry is. Like, even I can't say it's not excellent.
Even I can't.
I do read poetry, but I don't have a poetry, you know, I don't have a formal poetry
backgrounds.
Right,
I don't mean to presume that readers of poetry have to be poets.
No, but that's a totally legit question. And some of them I wasn't 100% sure where I had a feeling about them, that they were good, but I wasn't sure if, you know, it was my non-poetry background, you know, clouding my judgment. So I did ask for a second opinion in some cases.
Okay.
And the publisher was helpful in that as well.
Yeah.
So that was nice to have a couple of other prose taking a look.
Right, right. Yeah, because the publisher offers editing help.
Yes.
When they take a book. So, okay. Now, I wanted to ask you, you have a memoir coming out from Grey Wolf Press, which is very exciting. And I wondered if you could talk about that project.
Yes. So that project is a collection of essays, they're actually calling it. So it is kind of a large-scale study in place and how place shapes who we are, who we become, and how we can move forward from that while also keeping parts of it that help shape us. And specifically about where I grew up, which was in a very small town on the banks of the Kankakee River in rural Indiana. And it takes a look at place from the standpoint of the land itself, the social circumstances, the political circumstances, and then my personal story sort of interwoven with mm-hmm. that. And Grey Wolf, bless them, they are also allowing me to include three fiction pieces, which is really exciting that I get to do a little bit of hybrid work in this book. So how I'm using those fiction pieces within this particular framework is that at the end of each section, there's a short story that sort of submerges you further into the world that I'm exploring mm-hmm. in a way that I think adds dimension to everything that you see in the story. So in other words, like a cornfield is never just a cornfield. It's a place where people have had really important exchanges and really significant life events where migrant workers have worked, where teenagers have worked and fallen in love or had, you know,
partied or
ran away to in moments of despair. So it's kind of about a scarred land in a way as a result of how that area was formed. So almost, was it like maybe 1830s? That area was the largest marshland in the U.S., and there was an act that was passed during Andrew Jackson's presidency that allowed the government to basically negotiate treaties with Native Americans for lands that they wanted in the Midwest in exchange for undisclosed property in the West. So they did that in this area, and the Potawatomi Indians were sort of marched off the land at gunpoint, and the river or the marshland was drained, and the rich soil was turned into farmland.
Okay.
So that's kind of how the place was established. And when I lived there, and this still happens, that area just continues to flood every few years. Like the river just keeps going back to where it's supposed to be because they straightened it and they, you know, they dredged everything and really, really changed the landscape. But the landscape keeps trying to go back to what it used to be, which I thought was a really fascinating thing that a lot of my experience stemmed from that act that was passed in the 1800s.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to look at that in a way that had a much bigger meaning than my own little personal story.
So is there a story that talks about that time period?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah. And the fiction pieces, had they already been written when you took this to Grey Wolf?
They had. Okay. And about 70% of the book had been written. Some of it was added later. And the fiction pieces, I was realizing I was walking this line between my real experiences and fictionalizing them, and that they all really had to do with the same things in the same place and the mm-hmm. same themes and kind of the same people. So it made more sense to me to put them together than to keep them apart just for the sake of genre labels.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm really excited that they also agreed with that.
Yeah, that's great. So it's striking me that your collection, Please Do Not Remove, utilized artifacts to help people find their inspiration. And your collection is going to have like an inspiration of place. And so is that how you work? Do you usually find some sort of grounding that you can return to as you go?
Absolutely. That is how I work. And I always feel that my stories or essays rise up from artifact or place or something pretty tangible. And I sort of think abstractly around those things for a little bit and think about the experiences I've had that relate to those objects or places and how they can kind of make sense together.
Yeah.
So I start in that way.
Do you have An experience of trying to write a story because you had an idea for a plot and then it didn't work because it wasn't working that way?
Yes.
That's interesting.
I do have a couple of those. But I still hope to salvage someday, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, okay. So I know you've also been working on something else. Is it too early to talk about that?
No, I can talk about that.
Okay, great.
So I am working on a novel, which I think I will be done with in about 6 weeks. And I've been working on it for a few years. I've picked it up and put it down in... It is about digital inheritance. Basically, a woman inherits her sister's electronic possessions after her sister passes away and then is faced with a lot of decisions to make about how to handle that and whether she should do things like read her sister's email and explore who her sister was in that way versus who she was in her real life with the people that knew her on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And it looks at the tension that's created in between those things. And I'm having a lot of fun writing it.
Yeah, it's such a great premise. So it's... the character of the sister, is she somebody different in her digital life than she is as she presents herself in real life?
She is. Okay. But so, she's not the only one. It changes perspectives throughout the book, so we get to see what each different character's relationship is with the internet.
Okay.
In this way, or their technological belongings, and they each have different ways of using them, and different attachments, and different sort of vices with mm-hmm. them. So, yeah, I think everybody's a little bit different in how they use the internet and what their relationship is to people of the internet or information of the internet and how that affects their lives. So that's something I'm looking at too.
Okay. So I just want to step back to the anthology for a minute before we close. And I wondered if you could offer some advice for independent editors who might like to put together a collection or an anthology of some sort. Anything you're relieved that you did, anything you wish you'd done differently, and any general advice.
Yeah, I do have some advice. So I think if you're stuck on an idea for an anthology that keeps coming back to you as something you really enjoy putting together and other people are excited about, then that means it's something that people who are readers would also be interested in. And I'm really glad that I pursued my project because I think it is something that people are interested in reading and there's a lot you can do with it even after it's a book because it continues to inspire people to write or to read. The only thing I would do differently, I think, is that I should have trusted that a little bit more from the beginning, and maybe even pitched it as a nonfiction book to a publisher in the traditional sense, in the traditional approach, instead of sort of doing all the work myself and then trying to figure out how I was going to publish it.
Okay.
Although I'm very happy with how things worked out, so.
So what do you mean when you say a nonfiction project?
So you can pitch a book of not, I guess it. Or an anthology even as a pitch with some sample pieces.
You would have approached the actual submission to publishers more that way.
I think
way.
I would have.
Okay, instead of having the...
It would have been nice to have a little bit more support in getting pieces for the book rather than just me with my website and,
right.
you know, sending emails to people. So I think that's the only thing. It would have been nice to have a little bit more interest generated through a publisher.
Okay.
That could help you, you know.
That's really good advice,
yeah.
actually, because that probably would save you a lot of work and also rework if the publisher disagreed with anything that
you'd
already done.
That's true, and I have that experience where a couple of the pieces that I had chosen, the publisher decided not to include, so that put me in a tough position to have to backtrack on that a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, just kind of the breaks of publishing, but... I definitely learned from the way that I did it.
Well, that's good to know. That's good advice. Angela Palm, the book, Please Do Not Remove, a collection celebrating Vermont literature and libraries. Thank you very much for speaking.
Thank you, Shayla.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Angela Palm. You can learn more about her work at her website, angiepalm.com. And that's A-N-G-I for Angie. My second interview today is with Vermont poet Melissa Garlieb, whose new book is Handing Out Apples in Eden, published by Windridge Books of Vermont. Born in Milwaukee, Melissa Garlieb received a B.S. from the University of Wisconsin and a Master's in Education from Antioch University, weaving story, movement, and the arts into academic lessons. She has taught in Waldorf schools for 15 years. She currently teaches elementary grades from the alphabet to algebra at the Lake Champlain Waldorf School in Shelburne, Vermont. Her poems have appeared in Painted Bride Quarterly, Calyx, So to Speak, Off the Coast, and Compass Rose, among other journals and anthologies. In her debut collection, Handing Out Apples in Eden, Melissa Gharlieb has produced a book of warm and sometimes startling intimacy that grapples with issues at the core of modern relationships, the fluidity of identity and desire, the intersection of image and reality, the crux where personal and political collide in small acts of allegiance and betrayal. Often employing the lens of myth, art, and fairy tale, she draws us into her poignant personal history while simultaneously unfolding archetypes, holding and releasing emotional tension, trilling on the tongue. These poems, like arrows, fly straight to the heart. 10% of the book's net proceeds are donated to the Shelburne Museum. When I spoke with Melissa Gharlieb, I began by asking her about how she came to write poetry.
I started in grade two, actually, probably at age eight or so. I got very inspired by a book of poems about colors called Hailstones and Halibut Bones. And I checked it out a number of times from the school library. And I started to write my own small poems and hand them in to my teacher,
right,
who loved them.
Oh.
Unfortunately, I also copied some poems I found in other places and tried to pass them off as my own, but she was smart and caught me. And I learned from that.
She probably recognized the style was a little different.
Yes.
How old were you?
Eight, I think. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Okay, great.
I've also taken poetry in college, but just one semester of that, and then I started to take classes about 2 years ago from the Writer's Barn in Shelburne.
And you have an undergraduate degree and a master's in education, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So what's your undergraduate degree in?
It's also in education.
Okay.
In public school education, and then the master's degree is a Waldorf education.
Okay.
Master's degree.
So let's talk about Handing Out Apples in Eden. What was the evolution of the collection? How did this come to be?
So I realized at some point that I had enough poems to create a book. And I started to play with these poems and see what kinds of themes were in them. And I realized, well, a lot of them are about me.
Imagine
so,
that.
So why don't I start by putting them in chronological order and then start tweaking that a bit and seeing what parts of the story weren't quite told yet,
right,
and what parts I had too much of,
right,
and started to create a volume that had some cohesion to it.
All right. Were there poems that you had to cut that you were sad about?
Yes, there were.
Was that your own decision, or were there editorial decisions that were made once you got closer to getting published that you had to kind of grapple with?
The editors of this book only asked me to cut one poem.
Oh, okay.
So all of the other cuts were my own. And the poems I cut because I felt like their content had been said or taken up in another poem.
Right. So even though the poem was worthy, it may be a bit redundant.
Exactly.
Thematically.
Exactly.
Okay. Would you mind reading A Stutterer Introduces Herself?
Sure.
And then we will talk about it.
A stutterer introduces herself, or not, if the syllables come without sound and the mouth pantomimes the onset M in white gloves. She begins with her lips open so the penned up can slip out to grasp before morning's milking. Let it always be a county fair in May. Let more breath beckon a wheedling wind before the thunder of Big Top's speech. Everyone will look up, necks exposed, and wait as the clouds roll in. So the fluency is flexible. May a maundering farmhand amble the meandering mile, and consonants become malleable when struck or stuck by the jaw. But if blocked again, 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 the repetitions of ma, ma, ma might call to mind the bleat of judged goats in the grandstand, and you will feel ashamed of your adolescent associations. A trick trap door is underfoot for moments like this. Or, if you're kinder sort, maybe instead you'll hear the infant summoning mother, the first sensible uttering, and notice she's pretty, though her message is mazy. And if the confusion continues in this casual meeting of strangers, I suggest you generously let her build momentum or cancel the conversation completely. Some carousels are silent. She's looking away. Letting beginning be easy as ice cream, licking maple creamies melty at noon under the oak, make light contact with your eyes, and her tongue will make light contact in her mouth, and her larynx will release the mechanical latch, holding back the tin tine that plays the music of mute clowns. The melody holds most of the meaning anyway, and red lipstick smears all the M's.
Mm. Love that. And I love, let it always be a county fair in May. Is that the right line?
Yes, it is.
I love that line. Thank you for reading that. I'm curious, I just thought about this while you were reading. Do you think your stutter affected your decision to become a poet? Did it make you more interested in language, or do you think it's completely separate?
I think at an early age, I learned to speak less and to be really observant and to listen more. Uh-huh. And I think that has impacted me greatly. And I would also say that poetry slows things down enough that I can really grasp all of the nuances of the language that I don't always have access to in the moment speaking, because there's so much other work happening to get the actual words out.
Yeah. Do you feel like you write into or away from your stutter at all? Do you ever do that? For example, for this poem, because it's dealing with that subject,
right,
did you include certain words that you knew would be hard to pronounce?
Well, there are a lot of M's in that poem.
Right, and your name begins with M.
Exactly. So M's have historically been really hard for me to pronounce. It's not as true anymore, because I did a lot of work around M's and being able to say M's, and it's started to move into the S's and the F's a little bit more, and L's a little bit more, and so it's constantly changing. It's very fluid.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Okay. So do you ever write with the spoken word in mind? And
oh, I do. I read my own poems out loud over and over and over again, because I want to hear them, and I ask other people to read me my own poetry, to hear it back in another voice.
Yeah.
I think another way that I lean into the stuttering in my poems is that you'll find repeated sounds or repeated words or even repeated images across poems in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a stuttering quality to it.
Oh, yeah.
And that things come back again.
Oh, that's... So that must be fun to do. Is it fun?
Like, yeah, it's
think
fun
about
to play
it
around
play
with
around it.
Words and themes. And
yeah,
absolutely.
Speaking of playing around with words and themes, you have a poem called Heard, H-E-A-R-D. I wonder if you would mind reading that one. I really love that one, and then we can talk about it. There's some wordplay in there that I really enjoyed.
Heard. On autumn's first cold evening, I find my hat in parka sleeve, and cattle crowd the electric fence as I approach with too few bruised apples and unsettled belonging. All black mass in the dim, I hardly see their eyes glint. A few loaves break from dense breathing. Now among, some fence in me is suddenly slipped, and I join out loud, "That ribbon of highway I saw above me, that endless skyway." Calves freeze first as if remembering, as if saddle songs reside in one of four stomachs. A kindergarten teacher once told me he wooed his inner simpleton each day, and as this may be the only song these beasts will ever hear, I lilt longer, wanting them to know sweetness before stun. They all, then, these 60 or so brick beef Angus, advance hooves to my mezzo forte. Suddenly conscious and afraid of stampede, I turn homeward, humming to placate. One bull follows the line to enclosure's edge. I receive his seeing. Long bovine pleasures of pasture and herd, hours arriving and arriving with jaw of yellow bird's foot.
Mm. Thank you. The wordplay I was going to refer to is that the title is Herd. You are heard by this herd of cows when you sing your song, and then later you talk about long bovine pleasures of pasture and herd. So that was fun. And did you come up with the title after you already wrote the poem?
I did. I felt seen by the cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I wrote it, I realized, oh, I was also heard by the cattle. And so it seemed like a good title.
Right. And you do say that you are seen. I'm trying to remember that line, too.
I receive his seeing.
Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So to me, this sounded like a story that's based on a true event.
It was a true event. I was taking a walk on the roads behind my house, and I'm on a cattle farm, actually, and so I went to the cattle, and I don't know why, but I just started to sing to them, and they responded very strongly, actually, and it kind of freaked me out for a moment. I'm like, what could happen here? It's just me and the cows.
They're big, too, cows.
They're very big.
You know, you see them from the car, and they just look, oh, there's cows, but if you ever get close up, they are massive animals.
Yeah.
So do a lot of your poems start with a story, or are you more inclined to start with a turn of phrase or a feeling? Is there any pattern to that?
I think that most of my poems come out of a specific incident, though I'm always trying to find a turn of phrase, a particularly musical line,
mm-hmm.
Something catchy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then that sticks, and I'll kind of attach it to an incident.
Do you tend to work on a lot of poems at the same time, or do you become very focused on one and then move on?
I tend to do them one at a time, except that I'm never happy with it for quite a long time. I need to write one complete poem and then put it away.
Right.
And then come back to it over time and tweak it and change it.
Right. So you might be editing a draft while you're starting something new.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. You're a Waldorf teacher.
Yes.
And you mentioned your education in Waldorf teaching. What ages do you teach?
I am a class teacher, which means I take a group of children from first through eighth grade. And so I teach a wide span of ages, but it's the same group of children.
Right, yeah. Is there much turnover in the Waldorf classes? Like, do they stay for the whole time, mostly?
It depends. There's always your kind of core group that is there from grade one through grade eight. But there are kids who come and go.
Yeah.
And there are teachers who come and go as well.
Right.
But ideally, it's the one through eight block of time.
And I wondered how that feeds your poetry teaching.
Oh, it definitely has quite an impact because I'm teaching just topic after topic after topic. I mean, I don't get the chance to come back to it, come back to the same curriculum year after year, and so I'm constantly in brand new realms of material.
Right.
And as a Waldorf teacher, we tell stories to the children every day as well, and so I'm telling fairy tales and Greek myths, and I'm currently in Norse mythology, mm-hmm. and all of those images feed poems.
Now, you grew up in Milwaukee,
mm-hmm.
so Norse mythology must be something you're a little bit familiar with, right? Isn't there a large Nordic population there?
There's a German population there,
yeah.
and I am German, and so, but I didn't come to them until I started to teach, actually.
Oh, okay. Do you think you'd ever write children's literature?
Oh, yeah. I write children's poems to give to the students on their birthdays. So I already have quite a number of children's poems, and I'm currently trying to turn them into a manuscript.
Oh, fun. That's great. So you write a poem that's specifically aimed at the child whose birthday it is. Is that child
yes.
a character in the poem, or
no? It's more trying to capture either who that child is, or trying to capture what they might grow into, or mm-hmm. what needs strengthening in them, perhaps.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And it's not supposed to be too conscious for the actual child, and so you have to cloak it in imagery.
And that actually leads me to another question I had for you. You write about your life, and sometimes your life intersects with other people's lives, mm-hmm. and, you know, so some of your poems are quite personal, and I was wondering, first of all, how hard is that to sort of, like, be that vulnerable? And then how much do you work to maybe keep somebody out of it, even if you're telling your own story? Does that make sense?
Yes. I think it's important to risk yourself in a poem more than another person.
Mm-hmm.
So even if there are other people in the poem, I try to reveal me more than I reveal them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fine line, though, and I do my best. I went through quite an inner soul question of, can I actually put this book out in the world? Is this... am I brave enough to do that?
Right.
And I realized that if I chose not to, I would regret it.
Yeah.
That this was important enough to me, and I think it spoke to other people. And so I wanted it out there in the world, because I think that we need people to tell their authentic stories.
Yes. Have you had feedback from people who maybe are talked about in the book?
My ex-wife gave me permission, actually, to publish some of these poems that were about her and me together. And so I asked her, is this okay? And she said yes. So
that was
one person who gave me some positive
feedback. That was generous.
About that. It was
yeah.
very generous
yeah.
of her, actually.
I wonder if we could read, if you could read a poem that has to do with your son. It's mm-hmm. called Correspondence.
Correspondence. The sun is low in the window, and my 4-year-old son enters the bedroom. He knows what I've been doing. Paper, pen, words slowly coming. He holds out his supplies, blue construction paper and a yellow pencil. I'm going to write poetry, too. And he does. Ticks, dashes, array an ancient meaning before the knowing of alphabet. His efforts are all straight lines, and they glow on the dark paper at nightfall. Mama, what does it say? But I don't know what lies within him, and I falter. He reconsiders, studying the effect of formula, and states his two great purposes. Love, Keenan.
I love that. He has two great purposes.
He does.
So he's a bit older now. Does he read any of your poems?
He does not read these poems. He knows I have a book, and he's asked me to save him a book for when he's an adult, because I told him that he can read adult poems when he's an adult.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other poems that you've written that you maybe do show him? Have you ever shown him any of your other poems?
He's seen a few of the children's poems I wrote, and I wrote him a poem about learning to ride his bike last year, which he loved.
Oh, good. Okay. Is it okay if I ask you to read Long Division?
Mm-hmm. So this poem starts with an actual equation at the top, and it is longhand, and it is a long division problem, and the numbers in the division problem show up in the poem. Mm-hmm. So it's 115 divided by 3 equals 38 with a remainder of 1. Long division. Call it a house. A divisor always knocking at the front door. Begin. How many 3s in 11? 3 make a family. Pairs of lost mittens by naughty kittens. Baskets on the mudroom floor. Take the 9 months of 2 ribs kicked from the inside. Mother's heart propelled by the bruiser. Force of gait, of gale. Bring down the 5 years of family before she left to live in a one-bedroom basement. Life's tedium written out, indented, and descending. What's left and how many 3s in a last shiny quarter? That summer, 8 times they counted out saved change. Low back out, foundation slipped. She could barely walk the block for a root beer treat. The baby carried the purse. A quotient, 38, her age, appears after subtracting 24 months of separation, but a remainder of 1, before Solomon, child who cannot be split, but somehow must be shared. These should be friendlier numbers, and they shall have no pie.
Thank you for reading that. I love that last line.
Yes, it's another play on words, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it refers back to the nursery rhymes, and I just love that. The word placement on the page always interests me in poems, and you have a number of poems that have interesting word placement. This one in particular has life's tedium written out, indented and descending, and the words indented and descending are all increasingly indented on the page. Is it always thematic that you would move a word over? You know, for it's really obvious in this case that indented makes it a really appropriate place to do that. But
right, there has to be a purpose in my mind if you're going to play around with where the word is on the page. And so here, I'm trying to give the impression of the stairs that lead into the basement apartment. And it's also like the indention of the long division problem. And so
with
that.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, I don't know why I didn't think that. another line that is indented is child who cannot be split. Is that just because it refers to Solomon named above and you wanted to draw attention to it?
I wanted to draw attention to it because it is the remainder. It's the remainder of one. It's the child.
Yeah.
He's the most important thing, and so I wanted that to stand out in the poem.
It does. It's great. The actual printed page has, as you mentioned, the long division problem on it.
Mm-hmm.
So is that how it looked when you wrote the poem, and when you brought this to a publisher, were they excited to have some sort of like interesting diagram at the front of the poem?
Yeah, so this entire poem comes out of an assignment, a prompt I got to write a poem about something you are an expert in.
Oh.
And I thought at the time I would try to create a poem about teaching children to read, because I know how to do that. But that was too big of a topic. I couldn't put that down on the page. And so I was in my classroom, and there was a long division problem on the board. And it just came really quickly after that. It was perfect.
All right, great. I wonder if you can name a few of your own favorite poets, who you like to read or who has influenced you as a poet, perhaps. Mm-hmm.
I love Sandra Alcosser, who writes some beautiful, beautiful stuff and also takes some risks in her imagery. And let's see, I love Kim Adonisio because her poems are like a punch in the gut, and I love that. The ones that stand out, let's see. Ted Kooser is just a master, and I love to read his work. And an early influence was Jesse Lee Kercheval, who was a teacher of mine at the University of Wisconsin. And she was probably the first contemporary poet I ever met, and I got her book, and the cover of this book is actually a nod to her cover of World as Dictionary.
Oh, okay. Now I have to go look that. That looks that's fun. So, because the show is for writers, I always ask my guest if they have any advice. So I'm wondering if you have advice for aspiring poets, either something you wish you had known before you started or just anything that comes to mind.
I love to take poems I find that I admire and write them out in my journal.
Oh.
Because taking that much time to actually write out another author's words gives you insight into their craft in a way that I can't catch if I just read it.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice. All right. Thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you very much, Melissa. I'll just say, Melissa Garlieb, the book is Handing Out Apples in Eden, Poetry, published by Windridge Books of Vermont. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That, once again, was a conversation with Melissa Garlieb, whose name is spelled MalisaGarlieb. You can learn more about her work on her Facebook writers page and at her publisher's website, WindridgeBooksOfVermont.com. Windridge also published Please Do Not Remove, and more information about that collection, edited by Angie Palm, can also be seen on that site. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. And by Main Street Landing, creating places for people to work, play, entertain, meet, eat, and greet on Burlington's beautiful waterfront. Main Street Landing rents office and retail space on Burlington's waterfront, as well as daily rentals for meetings, events, and performances in their Performing Arts Center. Contact Melinda at 802-864-7999 or mainstreetlanding.com. I have no events for the Bookworm's calendar this week, probably because it's Christmas week and everyone is too busy out buying books for gifts to go to readings. At least I hope that that is why there are no events going on. Go buy a book. Today, however, I do have not just one, but two Write the Book prompts to offer, thanks to the generous suggestions of my guests, Angela Palm and Melissa Garlieb. Melissa's prompt is to write a personal poem using a mathematical concept or equation as the primary metaphor, as she did in her poem, Long Division. And then Angie's prompt is this. Select an image of a used library checkout card, several of which were provided by Angie and are going to be pictured on Write the Book's podcast site in the next couple days. So go have a look. Use any combination of the card's features as the source of inspiration for generating a new work of poetry or prose. Perhaps you'll be inspired by a particular patron's signature, a date stamp, or the book's subject matter or author. Perhaps you'll be struck by the card's appearance itself, or the accumulation or use or non-use. Let the image transport you to another time or place and draft some ideas or follow a single idea for 10 to 15 minutes. In revision and shaping of the draft, study the card again and allow yourself to do a little research that might further develop your initial impulses into a story or a poem or an essay. You may quickly find yourself pages deep into a story that you never knew you'd want to write. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the show and my blog from my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And then please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.